Today is the launch of the Guardian's This Is Europe Week, where we'll be highlighting the most pressing issues facing the continent. Later this week, we're going to be discussing the challenges facing the EU now that Britain is no longer a member. But today, we're talking about the rise of the far right in Germany and a referendum result in France.
So it's 10 p.m. on Wednesday night. We're at a shisha bar called Midnight in a side street in Hanau in Western Germany. It's a shisha bar like many others, one of those places that doubles up as a betting shop, just a place where you can just have a drink. The crowd is mixed, as it is typically in a town like Hanau, which is a very multicultural place, Turkish, people with Kurdish backgrounds, Romanians, Bosnians, Afghans, and a couple of them have German nationality as well. Suddenly, a black BMW pulls up outside this bar. A man gets out and immediately starts firing shots at people, at the waiters, at the people just sitting on the green sofas. And he leaving behind a scene of absolute carnage, gets into his car, drives just a couple of kilometers west to a district called Kesselstadt, where he gets out again at a betting shop stroke kiosk called Arena. He rings the bell, someone opens, and he shoots another five people. At the end of the evening, there are nine dead in total. He gets back into his car, goes back to his family home, and as far as we know, he then shoots first his own mother, 72 years old, and eventually turns the gun on himself.
People in the German town of Hanau are still in mourning after Tobias Ratjen's killing spree last month. Those people, many of them migrants with Turkish and Kurdish backgrounds, are all too aware that this was sadly not an isolated incident. In fact, it was one of a number of high-profile acts of far-right violence in the country in recent years. And once again, questions are being asked about why the authorities are not doing more to prevent them. From The Guardian, I'm Anushka Astana. Today in Focus, what is behind the rise of Germany's far right? Philipp Altmann, you're The Guardian's Berlin bureau chief. What do we know about Tobias Ratjen?
He was 43 years old and he was born in Hanau, went to school there. Ratjen was also a pretty successful footballer. In his youth, he played for the youth team of Eintracht Frankfurt, then had an injury, and there have been reports in German media that after that, he sort of began to turn inwards. About a week before the shooting, Ratjen launched a website. There's a long document, about 24 pages long, which is sort of him telling his life story. He writes coherently, but it is also clear that he was paranoid and extremely delusional. He writes that he has been under surveillance by a secret society or a secret intelligence organization since he was 2 years old. He clearly had a mental health problem. I think that's fair to say. He was also, obviously, from what we can tell from this document, he had a racist worldview. And he says basically that entire ethnic groups have to be eradicated from the planet. He writes that if there was a button that he could press, he wouldn't hesitate to do so, even if that meant killing billions of people and eradicating half of the world's population.
So clearly mentally ill, but with a very, very clear agenda. I mean, most people are describing this as a far-right terror attack.
I think it's right to call it a far-right terror attack because the motives here were clearly racist. And he wanted to cause terror. That much seems clear. He wanted to terrorize more than just the people who were in those shisha bars.
Put this into context for me. Is it part of a pattern of far-right attacks?
I think there's definitely a sense that this wasn't an isolated instance. So just 2 days before German authorities arrested 12 people across the country who had allegedly planned an attack.
It was here at an outdoor barbecue area close to Stuttgart that members of the suspected terror group reportedly met for the first time in September 2019. Their aim to provoke civil unrest by carrying out attacks against politicians, asylum seekers and Muslims.
On the 9th of October last year, we had a gunman in the eastern city of Halle.
Calmly and methodically, this gunman planned to kill Jews on their holiest day of worship, Yom Kippur. Dressed like a soldier, wearing a steel helmet, a camera is attached to it. The device transmitting live video to a gaming website. Behind the police cordon is a synagogue, the killer's target, but his plan failed.
Failed to get in and then just pretty randomly shot two people dead.
This evening, German Chancellor Angela Merkel joined Jewish worshippers in Berlin. This dark day, a reminder of the country's hateful past, and to sign anti-Semitism is hardly history.
That gunman had also released a sort of manifesto written in English, which clearly had mapped out a racist view of the world. A couple of months before that,
police in Germany have arrested a suspect in connection with the shooting of a CDU politician. Walter Lübcke, who was head of the city council in Kassel, was found dead in his garden last Saturday night, having been shot in the head.
A CDU politician, so a politician from Angela Merkel's party, who had been vocal in his support of her stance during the 2015 refugee crisis, was basically assassinated at his home, not far from Hanau. It's in the same state of Hesse.
This is an image of the alleged perpetrator from 2002. Whether he acted alone or was part of a group or even a network is currently not clear, according to authorities. However, the suspect, who was arrested at his home in Kassel, may have had help. Officials say the suspect, who holds a previous conviction for politically motivated crimes, had not been monitored in recent years.
We had the category of sleeper cells with the Islamists. So now we have to consider a scenario like this could also be possible in the right-wing extremist scene.
And even before that, we had those haunting scenes in Chemnitz in 2018.
The angry face of the far right in the German city of Chemnitz. Demonstrators hurling out a defiant call to all those who would criticize them. Get lost.
It started here when a German man was stabbed to death. The alleged killers, two refugees from Iraq and Syria. A week of angry anti-immigrant protests followed, with neo-Nazis, far-right groups, and thousands of ordinary citizens marching together. The protests stand as a watershed moment in the outpouring of anti-immigrant hatred that has swelled as Germany's far right grows bolder and stronger following the 2015 migrant crisis.
Does this go back even further than that?
We've had neo-Nazi violence in Germany going way back, I mean, throughout the 20th century, especially after reunification in the 90s. But if we're really talking about terrorist attacks, there was a really horrific and concerted terrorist killing spree throughout the noughties.
They called themselves the National Socialist Underground, a neo-Nazi terrorist cell that remained undetected for 14 years as it conducted a series of murders, bomb attacks and bank robberies.
A group that called itself the National Socialist Underground killed people across the country, and this group targeted people of migrant background and they shot them.
The Cesca 83 semi-automatic pistol equipped with a silencer. Cepa's fellow NSU members Uwe Bernhardt and Uwe Mundlos used the gun to kill nine people over the course of 6 years.
They didn't release any mission statements or manifestos afterwards, they just killed them. At the time, police and intelligence agencies sort of ignored these murders. They were horribly patronizing way, were called as the Donner killers, because some people who were killed worked in kebab shops. And it was just assumed at the time that this was some sort of gang warfare among the Turkish-German community. the real extent of this network was unknown or ignored until...
At around noon, a police helicopter spotted a burning motorhome. Two bodies were found inside. Police later determined that Mundlos had shot and killed Bernhard and then turned the gun on himself.
2011, when two of the members of this cell died in a fire, probably killed themselves, and the third one was arrested. And suddenly the extent of it has become clear, even though there's still numerous questions that remain over how this group was able to operate for so long and kill people without being detected.
For years, investigators focused on people connected to the victims rather than on members of the neo-Nazi movement. But the trial has barely touched on the authorities' failings, nor has it examined the role of German domestic intelligence, which had contacts in the so-called National Socialist Underground.
The murder that was closest to Hanau in the town of Kassel in 2006 was where a young 21-year-old guy with a Turkish background, Halit Yozgat, was shot behind the counter of his parents' internet cafe. And from what we know, there was a police informant who was sat in the internet cafe in one of the booths at the time, who claims to have walked out, ignored the body lying on the ground and just left some cash on the till. There's still numerous questions over what really happened and how much the intelligence agencies knew. A lot of the files on the NSU have been shredded and a lot of them barred from public access for a long time. One of the things that struck me when I went to Hanau, I was at this vigil on the market square, 5,000 people, it was absolutely packed. And I was just standing in the crowd talking to Turkish Germans or Kurdish German citizens. And I found it very striking that those NSU murders were the one thing that was on everyone's mind. People had loads of placards that said Hanau equals NSU.
Wir haben den NSU nicht vergessen. Wir haben Halle nicht vergessen. Wir haben nicht vergessen, was in Thüringen passiert ist. Wir haben nicht vergessen, was in Mölln passiert ist.
What a lot of people in the Turkish-German community in the area particularly are worried about, that it's not that there are far-right terrorists out there, it's the fact that the far-right could have infiltrated the intelligence agency and that they are not being properly protected.
Wow, so the people that you were meeting have been terrified by both the threat and the lack of protection for years and years. Do we know how big far-right extremism is in Germany and how organised it is?
According to the most recent statistics that we've got, there were over 24,000 active right-wing extremists in Germany in 2018, with just over half considered capable of carrying out violent acts. And the total number of such extremists is expected to have gone up in 2019. So there's something going on that is real, and which appears to have not been taken seriously enough in the past.
So the picture you're painting is of far-right extremism within Germany that is significant, growing, and perhaps organised, but not being dealt with. Is it because the authorities have been focusing on Islamist terrorism at the expense of far-right attacks, or is there something deeper than that, something profoundly wrong with the intelligence agencies?
I think for a couple of years, the domestic intelligence agency certainly focused its efforts on Islamist jihadist forms of terrorism. Around 2014, 2015, we did have a string of terror attacks with an Islamist jihadist motive. And it seems that all the intelligence efforts went into working out the networks behind that, but perhaps at the expense of organising another form of terrorism, which was forming at the time. But, you know, it appears that there was a problem in the domestic intelligence agency. So when there were the violence in Chemnitz in 2018, the then spy chief, the head of the domestic intelligence agency, which is called the Bundesverfassungsschutz, or member of Angela Merkel's conservative party, he was called Hans-Georg Maaßen, he made comments in which he alleged that what had happened on the streets of Chemnitz wasn't that bad. It had been misreported by the media.
Es liegen keine Belege dafür vor, dass das im Internet kursierende Video zu diesem angeblichen Vorfall authentisch ist.
He appears to have contradicted Chancellor Angela Merkel last week by questioning whether migrants were in fact hounded by far-right protesters following the fatal stabbing of a German man for which two migrants were arrested.
Merkel then moved to sack this guy, Maaßen. But what he's done since has been pretty worrying. I mean, he's been very vocal on social media, basically spreading conspiracy theories from new right media sources. He's co-founded a sort of pressure group within the CDU, which seems to advocate basically tacking right on social policies, on migration, and seems to suggest considering a coalition with the AfD, Alternative für Deutschland, the far-right party. So this raises some real questions to whether this domestic intelligence agency has been blind on the right eye for too long.
Blind or even complicit?
Even complicit. I mean, this is the worrying thing about the recent arrests. For example, one of these 12 people who arrested was a member of the police. There was a story that emerged about a prepper network of people who organized themselves via Telegram chat networks. The chat circled around how to target pro-migration politicians in the case of social collapse. Some people in this group had started stockpiling weapons, had started stockpiling body bags and quicklime, which you can use to basically stop corpses from rotting. A number of people in this Telegram chat network are part of an association called UNITA, which presents itself as a group that looks after people who are ex-military, ex-police, ex-security forces. So there are all sorts of points where this new form of radical right extremism that we are seeing, which is very organized, seems to touch with security forces. So this is something that I think is now being finally debated more openly.
It's over a year since Maaßen quit. Have the agencies changed their approach to this in that time? Has the government changed its approach?
On a rhetorical level, there has been a switch.
Ich möchte nochmal darauf hinweisen, dass die Gefährdungslage im Zusammenhang mit Rechtsextremismus und Terrorismus und auch Antisemitismus in unserem Lande sehr ernst ist. Ich sage das seit Monaten.
There have been a couple of concrete steps. Last November, Germany announced plans to basically restructure the domestic intelligence agency, hiring 600 new positions, especially targeted at potentially violent right-wing extremists.
Okay, so there have been real failures to deal with this, and progress has been very slow with some high-profile tragedies along the way. But what you're saying is they are waking up to the far-right extremism facing Germany at the moment. You've talked about the scale of it. I guess my next question is, why? Is there something you can point to that explains why this is happening?
From outside, the temptation might be to connect all of this to what happened in Germany in 2015.
Germany, a country where refugees are officially welcome.
There was an influx of new arrivals from Syria in particular, but from other countries too.
Not here.
Helfen, ja.
We should help them, but back in their own countries, where they come from, not here.
We have nothing against war refugees, but the mass immigration needs to stop. Germany can't manage.
It triggered a big political debate here, which it appears that it did radicalize parts of the country too. At the same time, I'm sort of reluctant to offer that as the explanation for something like what we've seen in Hanau and in Halle. I mean, in Hanau, there's been multiculturalism on the streets for a long time. It's nothing new. I mean, even Halle is a pretty multicultural, open, cosmopolitan city, actually. It's not like the world has radically changed for these people who then go on to carry out these attacks. I think what you can say is that there's been a debate in the public sphere that has allowed them to contemplate such plans. I mean, there has been new media has allowed them to find voices out there on the internet who fire up their imagination and their extremist tendencies and their thoughts. I mean, I think it's striking that with both Stefan Balliet, who was the 27-year-old gunman who shot people in Halle, and Tobias Rathjen in Hanau. Balliet referred to himself as an incel who believes that they can't get a girlfriend because immigrants are taking away all the women in Germany. Rathjen didn't use that term, but he does say he's never had a girlfriend in his life because this intelligence agency that he believed was controlling him had stopped him from ever having one. And with Rathjen, he recorded a video in English, which addressed Americans. I'm just struck that is something that's very modern about these the people who carry out these attacks.
Clearly, all of this is hugely complex, and there are global factors as well as things going on in Germany itself. But just focusing on 2015, you say those specific attacks were not directly linked to what happened on the ground, the spike in migration itself. But some are arguing that it could be linked to what was happening politically, to rising anti-migrant rhetoric that we heard especially from Germany's most high-profile far-right party, the AfD. They say it's nothing to do with that, that this is a mentally ill person killing people. But we do now have mainstream politicians like the CDU's Wolfgang Schäuble, who is president of Germany's parliament, pointing the finger at them, saying words can be turned into actions.
For the first time since the 1960s, Germany has got a far-right party in parliament, which entered in 2017.
Nazis out, the chant. But the AfD is in. And so left-wing protesters took to Berlin's streets within minutes tonight. The AfD has won more seats and influence than anyone imagined. So there's shock in a country still shamed by its Nazi history.
One of the highest guys from the AfD, and he said the Germans have to be proud what they did in the First and Second World War. And I mean, what did Germany do? Like, they slaughtered Jews and homosexuals, and I mean, this is nothing you can be proud of.
The Alternative for Deutschland, the AfD, was founded on a sort of anti-Euro ticket during the Greek debt crisis. But the party has basically turned ever more far-right, nativist, nationalist, especially after the 2015 refugee crisis.
This was a campaign ad, hostile to gay rights and to Islam. We want bikinis, not burkas, it says. And against the euro, too. The AfD wants to protect Germany and German culture.
One of the party's leaders, not at a national level, but at a state level in Thuringia, is a guy called Björn Höcke, who speaks in a way which is often veiled, it's often metaphorical, but it is really deeply reminiscent of the language of fascism.
Millions of people came here en masse last year or invited by Angela Merkel and her colleagues in the old parties. And they have plunged our country into a national crisis.
And he talks about the need for purging the country, for getting rid of elements that don't want to follow the path that the AfD is taking them down. And, well, I think you have to be very careful that you can't draw direct links between what Tobias Rathjen did in Hanau and what the AfD says. There is no proven link between him and the party, but there are echoes of the AfD and especially Höcke's language in Rathjen's manifesto that I think you also cannot ignore. The other thing that I think we shouldn't ignore is that the AfD, one of the things that is started to target in its poster campaigns, in Facebook campaigns, is shisha shops. They say shisha shops are this den of organized crime and that they need to be rooted out. They don't say go in there and shoot people with a gun, but the language that this party uses is very different to the language that any party in German post-war history has used before.
I mean, the big question for the other mainstream parties is how do you deal with the rise of far-right groups like the AfD? Historically, the temptation has been to try to keep them out of the conversation. But at the same time, they are attracting rising support. I mean, does that make it difficult?
That is the fear for the post-Merkel era. I think we all trust Angela Merkel to make sure that her party would never consider going into coalition with the AfD or even countenance a sort of deal where they tolerate each other. The question is whether her successor will stick to that line. And that's why we had this big scandal in Thuringia, where the CDU voted with the AfD to oust the state premier. It suggested that maybe there were parties in the center who are so hungry for power that they would work with the far right. This led to the resignation of the politician that we all assumed until then would eventually be Merkel's successor, Annegret Kramp-Karrenbauer, who is the party chair and the defense minister. Because this scandal had exposed the CDU, HQ wasn't in control of the eastern branches of the party.
You mentioned echoes of fascism. We can't get away from the fact that this story is unfolding in Germany, and we all know what Germany's history is. How has that affected mainstream politicians and even law enforcement authorities in the way that they try to deal with this? And does it affect the way that society responds?
Germany's Nazi past is something that the resistance against this Nazi past, the effort to not allow it to happen again, is central to what modern Germany is about. The fact that you have these vigils in the wake of an attack like Hanau, that you have 5,000 people turning up and that you have people chanting Nazis out, never again, does show you there is a deep-rooted awareness here of the lessons of history in this country. I mean, the entire political system is, in a way, built to avoid something like the rise of Hitler from repeating itself. In Germany, whether you have someone trying to storm a synagogue or entering a shisha bar to shoot people, the ghosts of the past, you know, the specter of fascism definitely hangs over it. I think the danger would be to moralize the problem and sort of make it abstract and something that is a history lesson, and as a result end up overlooking the concrete challenges that are there. I mean, to me, it looks like there's a problem with the security apparatus that needs to be addressed and need to take concrete steps to do it. When I was on the market square in Hanau, I was a bit puzzled. I mean, there were three politicians that spoke. There was the mayor of Hanau, there was the state premier of Hesse, and the German president, all gave speeches. They were very much in the spirit of remembering, warning about history repeating itself. But they somehow seemed slightly blind to the real people suffering in front of them. I mean, for example, it was striking that the names of the victims weren't read out. There was no one from the Turkish-German or Kurdish-German community who was invited to speak on stage. None of the relatives were there. It feels like sometimes the act of remembering can make it harder to get a clear sense of the problem in front of you. So I think that's the challenges for Germany.
Philip, thank you.
Thank you for having me.
That was Philip Alterman. Do look up his pieces on the website. Coming up, when anti-EU sentiment isn't listened to. Now, as part of our This Is Europe Week, The Guardian, in collaboration with Headlong Theatre, has released 7 short films. The series director Amy Hodge discusses them, including her surprise at discovering there was a 2005 French referendum rejecting the EU constitution 11 years before our own.
Since the Brexit referendum, there's been so much talk about the British relationship to the European Union. But how much do we really know about how other Europeans feel about the EU? In this series of films, we wanted to get beyond just the British perspective. You know, Europe is so diverse. There's so many different languages, cultures and histories. The Spanish film places us in a rural village where localism and the tradition that brings unites the community. Lots of countries are talking about immigration, but in Spain, the big issue is emigration. The EU for this character sucks the young people from her community. And now we hear this woman questioning why her boyfriend would leave this magical town to go and live in a city he doesn't know and work in a call centre.
¿Para qué? ¿A estar vendiendo en un call centre mierdas por teléfono? ¿Eh? ¿O a estar esclavizada con un sueldo miserable en una multinacional? ¿O qué? ¿A limpiar baños públicos?
Polish film follows a lorry driver who's talking about just how bad it was for him before the borders came down. There was a real lack of trust and endless waiting.
Czym jest dla mnie granica? Granica to poirytowanie, zmęczenie straszne.
For our lorry driver, Schengen has given him the capacity to follow the work and travel far and wide and make good money. But that has come at a cost. He's been so absent from his son growing up. But on the other side, the union has brought unprecedented economic opportunity for his children's generation. They don't need to leave and work to make the sacrifices that he had to make. The French film in particular showed just how little I knew about other countries' relationships to the EU. In the wake of our own referendum, I was fascinated to know that in 2005, a referendum was held in France to decide if they should ratify the proposed constitution of the EU. To the surprise of the establishment, the No campaign won. 55% of voters rejected the constitution, with a turnout of 69%. Many people voted because they were unhappy with their own personal circumstances or the notion of the economic liberalisation that the constitution offered. But 2 years later, under Sarkozy, the Treaty of Lisbon was voted through by Parliament, ratifying essentially the same constitution that the voters had only just rejected. The woman in the film is talking about how it feels to be part of a generation who had their vote ignored, to have a liberal economic system imposed on you despite it being rejected. She believes in the EU, but she wants an EU that puts the citizen first rather than the consumer.
Moi, je ne voulais pas d'une constitution qui gravait dans le marbre que l'Union européenne était celle du libéralisme économique.
We hear what it does to people's faith in democracy, to be part of a generation who are given the opportunity to vote, but then told there's only one right answer.
Le truc auquel j'avais dit non, auquel on avait dit non, Sarkozy décidait de le faire passer par la voie parlementaire, sans référendum.
We've all been bombarded over the last couple of years with information about the EU, but facts and figures can only give you so much. Fiction and film allow us to get deeper. We're always going to be part of Europe, but at a time when borders are going up, making connections through personal stories is more important than ever.
That was Amy Hodge, Series Director of Europeans. Do check out the brilliant series and the rest of The Guardian's This Is Europe Week on the website. That's it for today. This episode was produced by Josh Kelly and Courtney Youssef. Sound design was by Axel Cacoutier. The executive producers are Phil Maynard and Nicole Jackson. We'll be back tomorrow.